Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've got an interesting show today. Later this hour, we'll talk with two filmmakers whose works are currently featured in the PBS Short Film Festival. We'll hear more about their documentaries and where you can watch. We're also going to have an extended reporters roundtable today. Later, we'll hear from two journalists who've been covering the federal investigation into people and businesses with close ties to House Speaker Michael Madigan. But first, we want to note the deaths this weekend of two icons of the American civil rights movement. The first is the Reverend Dr. C.T. Vivian, an Illinois native who would become a top official in Dr. Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He would also go on to organize the Coalition for United Community Action in Chicago, which later became Chicago's Black Front. Vivian went to high school in Macomb, Illinois, and attended Western Illinois University there. According to the school, he participated in his first sit-in demonstrations in Peoria, integrating Barton's cafeteria in 1947. Vivian died at home in Atlanta. He was 95 years old. The other civil rights leader who died this weekend was Georgia Congressman John Lewis. Although not from Illinois, he did do some of his early work here in his leadership role with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Lewis and others set out to desegregate a public pool in Cairo, the city in deep southern Illinois. The challenges of that campaign were described a few years ago by fellow demonstrator Chuck Neblett, who was speaking at the time at Duke University.
This is Illinois. That was one of the meanest places I've ever been in. And that's the first time I went to jail. It was in Cairo, Illinois. And I went about five times, because every time I'd get out, we'd get in a demonstration, they'd pick on us. We're going back to jail. So we demonstrated at the swimming pool how bad it was. Kids would die drowning in the Mississippi River because that was a rough, it was currents in it, and all kind of currents. And our kids would drown because it's the only place they had to swim. Two or three people a year would die. And we demonstrated trying to open up the swimming pool, the public pool, for black kids to swim in. They wouldn't do it. Before they would desegregate that school, they filled it up with concrete. They fill it up with concrete. And it's that way today.
Congressman and civil rights leader John Lewis was 80 years old. The unequal conditions that people like Lewis and Vivian were fighting against are still in evidence today. And that is the subject of our first Reporters Roundtable. Joining us to talk about that are Kelsey Landis and De'Asia Page, the reporters with the Belleville News Democrat, and Dana Cronin, who's an agriculture reporter for WILL and Illinois Newsroom. And I want to welcome you all to the program today. Thanks for being here. And Dana, I want to begin with you. You've been reporting on food insecurity. Can you tell me about the study you recently looked at coming out of Northwestern University?
Right. So, like you said, this was a study out of Northwestern University. Basically, it found that levels of food insecurity across the country, including Illinois, have never been higher, not even during the Great Recession. And unsurprisingly, Black and Hispanic families are being disproportionately affected. So the study took into account data from the Census Bureau. It looked specifically at households with children, and it found that about 22% of white households are struggling to afford food right now. But meanwhile, 40% of Black households and about 36% of Hispanic households are reporting food insecurity. And I talked to the lead researcher, her name's Diane Schanzenbach. She told me those numbers were incredibly shocking to her, and they also show the depths of the recession we're in right now due to the coronavirus. She also told me this really highlights how necessary food benefit programs are right now, including the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, mm-hmm. for which many are lobbying to increase funding until the economy gets back on track.
And I want to come back to SNAP a little bit later, so let's put a pin in that for now. But can you, what is food insecurity? Can you, maybe people aren't, you know, who have comfortable lives right now listening to this program may not understand what that actually looks like for people. What does that mean?
Yeah, food insecurity is essentially, you know, if you're not earning a paycheck, especially now during the pandemic, a lot of people have lost their jobs. You go to the grocery store and you simply can't afford to put food on the table for your family. And it's, you know, like this study shows, it's gotten a lot worse since the pandemic started. And that's because of the unemployment rate. And that's also because a lot of families have lost access to free or reduced price school meals that they usually have access to when school is in session.
Yeah, and a lot of people in Illinois do take advantage of those programs. Okay, so that is one set of disparities that we've been talking about is food insecurity. And as we just heard, it's a problem that's been there a long time, but the racial disparities in particular are really coming to the forefront in this pandemic. And now I want to turn to another aspect of racial disparities that we've seen highlighted on account of the pandemic. And De'Asia Page with the Belleville News Democrat, you and your colleague Kelsey Landis, analyzed data on the distribution of COVID-19 cases in St. Clair County. Can you start just by talking about what were you looking for when what did you find when you set out to analyze these numbers?
Yeah, so when looking at the data, I mean, we already knew that Black people across the nation were 3 times more likely to contract COVID-19, and that sort of rang true in St. Clair County because almost half of the confirmed cases were from Black patients, although Black people just make up 30% of the population. And also Black majority communities in St. Clair County have twice as many cases per capita as mostly white communities when comparing zip codes with similar testing rates. So, yeah.
Wow. And I just want to emphasize that there. So, I mean, you're saying that half of the cases were Black patients, even though it's just, what did you say, 30% of the population?
Yeah, they only make up 30% of the population in St. Clair County. So.
Wow. Kelsey Landis, I wonder, and I should remind listeners, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just joining us, we're beginning our reporters roundtable looking at some of the inequalities that have been highlighted by the COVID-19 crisis. We just heard there from De'Asia Page, who's a reporter at the Belleville News Democrat. Earlier, we heard from Dana Cronin with WILL and Illinois Newsroom. And we're also joined by Kelsey Landis with the Belleville News Democrat. Kelsey, when you were talking to people about these disparities, were they surprised? Is this what they expected? Can you talk about some of the reaction you got in the community?
Sure. Well, you know, I should preface it by saying that St. Clair County has, and the Metro East in general, has a long history of racial segregation and inequality between white communities and Black communities. And so the problem is well known by residents, by the politicians who represent our area. And so, no, people weren't surprised. I mean, we talked to Tamara Cummings. She's a receptionist at Touche Regional Hospital in Centerville, Illinois, which is the closest hospital to East St. Louis residents. And both communities are predominantly Black. And what Tamara told us, you know, here's a quote from her. She said, when we told her about the high rates of coronavirus in Black communities, she said, "What doesn't affect us? We always take hits. We take the hits and we're built to keep going and keep going until we can't take no more." So they're not surprised. The residents aren't surprised. We talked to, State Senator Chris Belt and U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. And they hear about these kind of issues all the time, the complicating factors of health issues, diabetes, asthma, food insecurity, like Dana was talking about, environmental factors from heavy chemicals being burned and incinerated and then spewed into the air. The public health administrator in the East St. Louis area told us that people there aren't that surprised either. They say, "We can't breathe good anyway." And so when they were hit with yet another problem, no, they weren't surprised. I think the difference this time is that this is one of the first times in Metro East history that white people and white communities are finally paying attention, and not only paying attention, but caring and maybe taking action and maybe doing something, whatever small part that they can do to start to recognize this. It's a well-known problem, but now white communities hopefully are starting to turn the page to take action.
Well, can you talk about what are some of those actions that you're seeing from the white members of the community there?
Sure. You know, it's sort of hard to quantify at this time, but I think just seeing protests and demonstrations in towns where, you'd never seen it before in Southern Illinois. The town of Freeburg in the Metro East had a Black Lives Matter protest recently, where a lot of young people are coming out and supporting that movement. And I think it's just becoming more visible, and it's becoming more difficult to ignore the issues that Black communities are facing.
And De'Asia, I was interested, you talked in your article as well about, because one of the things we've heard from people, including the President of the United States, is that, well, you test more and that's why you find more cases. And you kind of looked at that aspect of this in your data analysis about testing. Is that why there are more? It's not right. I'm kind of spoiling the answer, but can you talk about that? You know, the question of whether testing is what drove the case increase or the higher number of cases in those communities?
No, testing is not the reason why there's a higher rate of confirmed cases. In the data that we saw in Black and white zip codes with testing rates within 1.5 percentage points of each other, the predominantly Black zip codes saw double the infections. So it wasn't because there was increased testing that accounts for the higher rate of confirmed cases. That's just not something that's true. Black people are still disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 in general. That's why there's more infections.
You know, I'm curious, De'Asia, in your reporting, if the idea of distrust of government officials and the media came up. This is something we've talked about before on the program, that especially in African-American communities, there's a long history of distrust of both the press and the government in terms of, both information distribution and the way, the government sort of takes care of people. And I wonder if that's something you came across in your reporting at all on this.
Well, there's certainly like a lack of distrust in healthcare for sure. There's a long history of medical bias in research. For instance, in the early 20th century, there was a Tuskegee study that mainly focused on trying to research syphilis within Black men in the South, but they never told the Black men that they were researching syphilis, and they never treated those who contracted syphilis either. So there's a long history of Black people not trusting healthcare in general, just because of what's happened in the past in terms of medical research and basically just using Black bodies as this experiment without really treating them. So that kind of rang true in our story, as some people were actually just reluctant to go to the hospital to see if they even had COVID, just because they don't really trust healthcare. So,
Dana Cronin, I want to bring you back into the conversation. Now, I said earlier, you were mentioning, as we were talking about some of these disparities, food insecurity, and you said that some of the people you talked to thought there needed to be an increase or an extension of increased benefits. Can you talk about what has changed? We've only got a couple of minutes left in our segment, but what has changed with SNAP benefits during the pandemic?
Sure. So as part of the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, which was passed back in March, Congress allocated funding to expand SNAP benefits, meaning that all households would earn the maximum amount of benefits available. And for those that don't know, the way SNAP benefits are allocated depends on household size and income level. But under current guidelines, all households, regardless of size and income, are earning maximum benefits. But the question we've been hearing from a lot of SNAP recipients in Illinois is how long those maximum benefits will be issued. So last week, I talked to a woman named Leslie Cully, who oversees the program for the state. And she told me that, for those that are wondering, maximum benefits will be available this month, July. But beyond that, she says it's up to FNS, the Food and Nutrition Service, which is an arm of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And she told me she doesn't expect that they'll stop issuing maximum benefits, at least anytime really soon. And that's especially because we still have an emergency declaration in place in Illinois. And she says as long as that's in effect, she'll continue asking for those maximum SNAP benefits. And it's just a matter of whether FNS will continue distributing them. So right now we're kind of on a month-to-month basis when it comes to those max SNAP benefits.
Well, I'm sure it's a story we will continue to follow in the weeks and months ahead. Dana Cronin is the agriculture reporter for WILL Illinois Newsroom and Harvest Public Media. Dana, thanks for being with us this morning.
You're welcome.
And we've also been speaking with Kelsey Landis and De'Asia Page, both with the Belleville News Democrat. De'Asia and Kelsey, thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you.
And more to come after a short break. Before we take a break, I do want to remind our listeners, just take a moment to say that we have a new initiative here. It's called Text the 21st. I guess it's not that new anymore. We've been doing it for a couple of months now. But we want to make a pitch for joining our texting group. We've been hearing interesting things from you, our listeners. It is guiding our coverage in some ways. You can join Text the 21st by texting the word TALK, that's T-A-L-K, TALK, to 217-803-0730. Again, the word is TALK. The number is 217-803-0730. You can find out how to do that on our website, which is 21stshow.org. Coming up after the break, House Speaker Michael Madigan appears to be of interest to federal prosecutors. We'll have that conversation in just a minute. Stay with us.